Podbean, your message amplified.
Ready to share your message with the world? Start your podcast journey with Podbean.
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 Podbean. The AI-powered all-in-one podcast platform.
Thousands of businesses and enterprises trust Podbean to launch their podcasts.
Launch your podcast on Podbean today.
My school uses Podbean.
My church, too.
I love it. I really do.
Running an online business is hard enough without the stress and time consumption of managing hosting. Whether managing one WordPress site or dozens, Kinsta's managed solutions offer speed, enterprise-grade security, and an intuitive dashboard. With 24/7, 365 human-only expert support, get peace of mind that your sites stay online, secure, and performing their best. Start today and get your first month free with migrations handled for you. Learn more at kinsta.com/podcast. That's kinsta.com/podcast.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to my first show of 2025. It's great to be back. Tonight I'm going to be talking all things coaching. My guest and recognized leader in the field of coaching, Michelle Miller. So we're thinking about what is coaching, how does it work in education, why is it so important, and what mistakes schools do when trying to utilize coaching as a CP model of development. We're also going to be talking a bit about life coaching and looking at all things coaching. Like I was saying, it's great to be back for 2025. I'm hoping you've all had an awesome week. It's fantastic to be here. So tonight, my guest, I think she's come through now, is Michelle Miller. Can you hear me, Michelle?
I can, Dave. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. You're coming through nice and clear. So that's fantastic. So like I said in the intro, tonight we're talking about coaching. So I'm not sure if our listeners have heard about coaching. The institution that I work in has gone for coaching in a big way in terms of teachers' CPD, which is what interests me about it and why I wanted to speak to Michelle a bit more about it in terms of what it is, how it can be utilized by schools, how it works as a CPD model. We're also going to do a bit of live coaching between myself and Michelle. I'm a bit nervous about it, but we'll see how it goes. It's going to be interesting. So welcome, Michelle. It's great to have you on this Friday night.
Oh, that's so kind. I'm really looking forward to speaking with you, Dave, and to sharing some thoughts around how we could use this to benefit our students and also our own professional development and thinking.
Fantastic. So could you just tell our audience a bit about your background?
So I qualified as a teacher way back in 1990. So I'm a really proud educator. For me, my strap line would be that education changes everything. And I believe that when young people get a great education, then they have so much of the opportunity that life presents. So for me, education is literally life changing. So I'm a really passionate educator. Quite quickly, back in 1990, I guess teaching and learning was really underdeveloped, if a thing at all. And as I progressed in my career, the idea that we should be held account to our young people for the quality of the education that they receive kind of emerged. Ofsted was not around when I first qualified. And over time, I think that I have become really interested in all of the research, the cognitive science that is out there that tells us what we do when we are really effective in our teaching so that our students can learn. And so I have become really interested in this whole world of teaching and learning and thinking about learning. So as a teacher, I progressed fairly in a standard kind of way. I became a head of a curriculum area, then became a senior leader. And that coincided with an opportunity to write materials for teachers and then train materials for teachers. So over time, I have spent less time as a teacher and gradually moved into the world of working with teacher learners and adult learners. And alongside that, back in 1998, I qualified as a sports psychologist. I had a real passion for high performance and understanding the psychology behind high performance. And so I've had a dual career, which looks at how we learn alongside how we perform. And so I really try in my work now with schools to bring those two worlds together so that as teachers, as leaders, as thinkers, and as students, we can maximize the opportunities that learning has to offer and use them when things are hard just as well as when we use them when things are less hard. So I currently work for a number of organizations. So I work individually with many schools and really think about how we're leading and thinking about learning in schools to improve, no matter where you are on that journey of improvement. I also work for the Schools Alliance for Excellence, which is an education partnership organization that looks after and has a relationship with many, many schools out of the 400 that are in Surrey. And I still practice as a sports psychologist. So I would say that I am really fortunate to have a very varied menu of activities that I do, some of which I manage and lead myself, and some of which I work under the auspices of other organisations.
Yeah. So I've got many follow-up questions. I guess the first one would be, was your subject PE or sport as a teacher? Is that how you got into sports psychology?
Yeah, so my original degree was in sports science, and I think it might have been in year three of my degree, I was introduced to this idea of sports psychology, and the lights all just went on around me. I just thought, this is what I love. This is what I'm really interested in. And back then, sports psychology was not something that was particularly established in the UK. It was more established in the US. And so I really was interested in how our thinking and our learning impacts on our performance, and whether our performance is at an Olympic Games or whether it's in an exam as a student, some of the principles are really, really similar. So, so I started off doing a sports science degree. Then I had to go back to university and I did a master's in sports psychology at Loughborough. And then I had to do a 5-year supervision experience to then really fully qualify back then as a sports psychologist. Mm. And then along the line, I switched from teaching PE to teaching psychology, which was predominantly at A-level at the time. But now I know that many schools have also do a psychology offering at Key Stage 4 as well.
Yeah, I mean, before we really get into what you would define as coaching, have you therefore seen a change over the last, say, 20 years in terms of acceptance of coaching as a CPD model?
100%. Absolutely. I think I have seen a profession in terms of the teaching profession as one where we went from almost a laissez-faire organization, kind of do what you like in the classroom and let's hope it works. That was very much sort of early 1990s. Then that morphed into a heavily monitored organization or profession where we had, you know, the very close monitoring of, practices in the classroom. I remember prior to one Ofsted inspection that I was getting ready for, sitting up at about 3 o'clock in the morning thinking, I want to teach this lesson, but how am I going to get technology in there? Because you had to get technology into a lesson in order to get a tick in the box as that lesson being effective. And we now know that obviously, you know, there are some things that add value to some lessons and there are things that absolutely aren't necessary in every lesson. And so now I think we've moved into another phase where we are much less about proving what we do and we're moving to improving what we do, away from monitoring and into the world of curiosity. And I think that's what I've seen and that's where coaching comes in. Because what it does is it allows the teacher, the professional, to be curious about what's possible rather than to be told what they need to demonstrate in order to be successful.
So we're talking about coaching. We're the whole show tonight is about coaching. So I guess the first thing is, and maybe the most important is, what would you define as coaching? Like people say about coaching, it's coaching models for CPD, and someone just, you know, okay, well, what is it? So how would you define it?
So at its most simple, coaching is about thinking around what is the solution to a specific issue and the opportunity to explore possible solutions with the luxury of having someone to think alongside you. And that coming alongside you can look different depending on where you are in that thinking. So essentially, coaching is thinking with a partner to develop your practice.
That's really interesting. So, I mean, how does that pertain, would you say, to education and teaching then?
So I think the thing that I've learned about teachers is that we're really fortunate in that we all share what I would call a common why. So Simon Sinek talks about the importance of establishing why you do what you do. He talks about this idea that many leaders and thinkers are really good at explaining what they do and how they do it. But when we look at the really inspirational leaders on the planet, they are the people who start with why. And I think that was the title of Sinek's first book, Start With Why. So our collective why with teachers, and I think I would guesstimate that I've asked the question now, why are you a teacher, of about 12,000 professionals. And what's really interesting is that not once has anyone come back with something to do with the statistic or a Progress 8 score or a SATS outcome. What people come back with is, I want to make a difference. I want to pass on my passion for my subject. I want to make a difference for young people because I know that when they learn, they have great opportunities in front of them. I want to make sure that regardless of a young person's starting point, they have equal access to the opportunities that education brings. So for me, coaching in education allows teachers to really deliver for themselves what they want in the classroom, which is, how do I do a great job here?
Michelle, just interrupt for a second. I was going to ask, has anybody ever said to you, because it's a decent job with okay pay and I like the holidays?
Well, do you know what? It's funny. When I do the activity, I always say to people, come on, somebody's got to prove me wrong here. Somebody's got to say, give me a Progress 8 score or a percentage. Or somebody's got to say, no, I've got to pay my rent or my mortgage. But do you know what, guys? There are far easier ways to do that. And if that's your driver, then education probably isn't why you're really in it. Usually people have a passion, whether it's rooted in a personal experience or a teacher that they had. And of course, we all get distracted by the other, the things that life can throw at us at times around the practicalities. But fundamentally, I really believe that teaching is too hard to do if you're not in it for really making a difference. You know, when you look at what teachers are prepared to sacrifice, the time that they spend, the challenges that they face, most of them, the very, very vast majority of the teachers that I have ever worked with are really invested in really trying to think about, how do I teach so that these young people benefit from that?
Have you ever had, have you ever done the coaching and someone has actually decided, you know what, teaching isn't for me, I actually aren't feeling good in this job, and actually going through this has made me sort of think, you know what, it's time for me to get out?
You know, I mean, when I've coached in various different guises. So when you're talking about career choices, then of course we have colleagues who get to a point and for whatever reason in their career that they decide that teaching isn't for them. And yeah, for sure, we can all think of colleagues who've made that decision. And actually, I've also had many colleagues who've made that decision and then at a later point come back to teaching in some way. So, yeah, for sure, you know, it's not for everyone for always. And I think it would be unrealistic to think that, you know, everyone is as hungry as they are on day one, as they are in year 34, for example. But, you know what, this job, it demands an awful lot of us. And I think that what coaching does is it allows you to connect back to our core purpose and to maybe switch off some of the noise around maybe some of the other tasks that we sometimes are asked to do or need to do that take us away from that real making a difference aspect of our job. Mm. And so if the coaching is about teaching and learning, for example, we get really into the detail of, you know, how can I do this better so that my students benefit? How can I lead my peers so that they are better?
Mm. So is there a huge difference? I know in terms of your sports psychology, you've, you know, worked with Olympians. Would you say there's a massive difference in terms of what you do with them and then what you do with teachers? Or is it very, you would say, actually, they're very, very similar?
I would absolutely say that whether your performance is at the Olympic Games or in the classroom, the techniques and the ideas that I use are really similar. Because I think when you understand how we think and feel and the things that matter to us and the things that can get in the way of that, then I think whatever your arena of performance is, we can utilize or leverage a number of different ways of thinking that whatever your arena might be, that you can benefit from coaching.
Hmm. That's fantastic, Michelle. So we're going to go to our first ad break, and when we come back, I'm going to be discussing sort of mechanics of coaching in terms of CPD in school. So stay tuned, everybody.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishers of professional development books and resources that support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Don't miss out. Level up your professional development today and visit johncattbookshop.com to explore the full range of titles. Use the code JCTTR2425 for 20% off your order. Happy reading.
Meet USA Study, your one-stop platform for guiding students through their college application journey. Access up-to-date resources on universities, programs, scholarships, and application requirements, all in one place. Get easy-to-access tools, personalized timelines, expert tips, application templates, and exclusive webinars with admissions officers to help your student stand out. Visit usastudy.co.uk or call Phil at 0800 612 8271 because every student deserves the opportunity to shine with USA Study.
This show is...
Cool, and we're back. So my next question, Michelle, is what's the difference between coaching and mentoring?
So I guess at its purest, we would say that mentoring is where you work with somebody who is at the earlier phase of expertise. So they don't necessarily have a full toolkit yet. So mentoring can be very much more about telling or modelling and showing. Hmm. Whereas coaching is really what we use when we are with somebody who has got a fairly full toolkit, but that they can or they would benefit from thinking more deeply about their options and their solutions. Having said that, instructional coaching, which is the model that I favour, has the capacity to do both of those. It's just that you're operating at different ends of a continuum when you do so. But broadly speaking, mentoring is more telling, coaching is more supportive thinking.
And so how can coaching be utilised in teacher CPD? Like, what are the... Is there just one model or have you seen different models at different institutions?
Sure. So broadly speaking, there will be many threads that link whatever way in which a CPD program around coaching is utilised. But there are lots of different models of coaching. And one of the things that's really interesting in teaching is that we have been guilty in the past of verbally describing what we want to see and then assuming that the person that we're working with really gets what we mean. So I can describe to you, I can say to you, Dave, you're questioning, if it was a bit more precise, the students would really benefit from that. So can you please try and make your questioning a bit more precise if I was giving you feedback? And then you, Dave, go off and do your version of precise, but actually that still might not be really beneficial for the students. So what coaching offers is the opportunity to really unpack that. And we've got in coaching this idea of what we call praxis, which is, okay, we both heard the word precise there, but now what we could do is we could sit down and I could say to you, okay, so let's look at a lesson that you're going to be teaching maybe next week. Let's look at a question within that lesson. How would you make that more precise? How would I make that more precise? What are our options here? And then you can start to, I can start to model with you, if you don't have a full toolkit yet, what I mean by that and the process that I use to get there, as opposed to just saying to you, Dave, it'd be great if your questioning was a bit more precise, and then crossing my fingers and hoping you could do that on your own.
So one of the things I read in preparation for this show was from the CFBT Educational Trust. And it says that coaching is one way that teachers can focus on the intellectual and practical challenge of their practice, as opposed to the burdensome nature of their job. It's an interesting quote. So could you possibly explain or give examples of how coaching can do this?
So I think, listen, in our profession, we do a lot. It's really hard to find a teacher that isn't super busy. But are we busy on the right things? So if the thing that makes the biggest difference to student learning is the quality of teaching, and the research tells us that that is the case, then if we spend our real professional learning opportunities improving how we teach, then the students get the very best benefit from that, and the teacher gets to fulfill the reason why they want to teach, as opposed to perhaps me doing some CPD, thinking about some administration task. Now, I'm not saying that those don't have a place in school, but if we get the balance wrong on that stuff, what can happen is that we can be really busy, but busy doing things that don't necessarily maximize the benefit of that learning for our students. So I think what we're talking about here is, let's be clear about the best bets for adding value to learning. And let's spend time sharpening our toolkits so that when we do those things in classrooms, we're not just doing them at surface level, but we're doing them with impact for learning.
So you travel around to a lot of institutions. What barriers do you see, or like clashes between the coaching model you're talking about and many schools' improvement mechanisms?
Oh, it's so complex. I think the obvious one, Dave, is time and resource. You know, the one thing that teachers are is time poor. And again, you know, if you think that the evidence tells us that the one thing that will make the biggest difference to learning is the quality of teaching, then my argument would be that so much of our professional learning time should be spent on really thinking deeply about how we teach better. So one of the barriers to that is time. So most teachers, you know, teach at least sort of, you know, well, we know we teach 90% often of our time is spent in the classroom. Then we've got a very small amount of time left, if you like, to prepare for those lessons and then to prepare the feedback and assessment follow-ups that those lessons will generate. So we're really time poor. And unless your school has a really great commitment and a frequency around professional learning, and within that, a commitment to focusing on the things that make the biggest difference, there's barrier number one. I think the other thing is that in our schools, professional learning can sometimes be, the intention is there that it's going to be really impactful, but the opportunities are minimal. So we give lip service to it. So I think one of the barriers is time. The other thing that I think is really complex is that where it works best, coaching is decoupled from evaluating, judging, or monitoring teacher performance. So if you want somebody to be in a learning position, then we need to reduce the anxiety that, you know, that I'm going to be judged on what I'm doing. And I'm going to come back to this phrase. We need to move away from this idea that I've got to prove myself to my leaders, and I want to be more focused on how I improve myself. And coaching is a great mechanism for that. So I think those are two of the really obvious barriers: time and resource to make that time happen and available, and to put coaching in there in those opportunities. And the second one is, if we decouple coaching from performance-related pay, then what we get is teachers who can be naturally curious without being concerned that they're being judged, monitored, and really held to account. Now, obviously, schools have a function around the need to make sure that our teachers are doing a really good job. So, of course, we've got to have accountability. But I believe that coaching is most successful where it is purely about how do I get better rather than how do I prove that I'm good enough.
So on that idea, I was just thinking, how is coaching success as a CPD model quantifiable? Like, if you're going to make a judgment about, is it working? Like, obviously schools want to make judgments all the time. That's one of the problems. Is it working? Well, let's see about exam results or teacher performance, or, you know, it's almost, you know, impossible to sort of nail down. But is there some way to judge the success of coaching on a school-wide basis as well?
Sure. I think the answer is yes and no, without sounding like I'm sitting on the fence. So the yes bit is, in as much as we can quantify anything that we do in the classroom. So it's really difficult to say that because I do X, students perform better. Because what we do is so multifaceted that it's very difficult for us to attribute performance to one action that we do in the classroom, because it's the interaction of so many different elements of great teaching. So if you're looking at coaching as an element of what makes great teaching, then I think we have got some proxies for learning that are fairly reliable. So if we think about, you know, the things that teachers do that have impact, then we can start to measure some of those. But I don't think it's as simple as saying, oh, Dave's just started coaching, his students seem to be performing better, it must be because of coaching. So I think it's very difficult for anything to have a really simple cause and effect relationship. But I do think that certainly what I find is that when teachers really engage with coaching, what happens is that they think more deeply about what they're doing. They reflect more deeply. They then are engaged in a cycle of practice, trial and error, reflection, review, improvement, and so on. So I don't think that there is a really easy, quantifiable measure. But there's loads of research out there that says that, you know, coaching is one of the biggest levers that we have for improving professional performance, if you want to call it like that, or teaching in the classroom.
So can it work then on a school-wide basis, in the sense that, I guess, people listening might say, well, that's all well and good, but clearly, Michelle, she's worked with Olympians, she's got this incredible experience, she's a sports psychologist. There's no doubt that one-to-one, Michelle Miller could help me with my teaching. But I'm not quite sure how it would work with a less experienced person or just going into a school. So I guess it's like, how does it work in terms of scaling up, in terms of a school going, oh, we want to do coaching as our CPD model? It's like, yeah, but not every teacher is going to have the same experience as yourself does. So what do you recommend to schools in that sense that works?
So listen, you know, I'm very flattered that you just said all those lovely things about me. But I'm a teacher at heart. I happen to have other experiences, and as a teacher and as a coach, that's where I'm drawing my experience from. And I've worked with some absolutely just fantastic teachers who are brilliant coaches. And so I don't think that you need, you know, a long resume of qualifications to be a great coach. There are many coaching programs that we can engage with, and there are many schools that I know where they have either used an external trainer to empower and to educate staff in schools to be coaches. And there are some schools that I know that have taken a far more simple approach and done a coaching awareness raising as a whole staff, where we read articles together, where we practice together, where we really think about this together. So at its best, yes, there will be an element of awareness and education, but at its least developed, it can be really, really effective. Because what we're actually saying here is, how do we have good conversations that inspire, support reflection, and are safe places for professionals to think together about how they can improve without fear of judgment or criticism. And so when you talk about scaling up there, I think that's a really, really interesting point. We've already talked about the notion that in schools, one of our barriers is time and essentially money, because teacher time equals money, and schools haven't got that. So if you're talking about a model where every single member of staff has a one-on-one coaching conversation pretty regularly, I can imagine that that's really hard to scale up, unless you have a very large body of coaches within your organisation. But if you look at the work of people like Dr. Rob Coe or Professor Rob Coe at Evidence-Based Education, one of the things that they started to do is to look at the fact that these are some of the constraints, if you like, for schools. And so they've come up with a coaching model which is much more scalable and much more cost effective. And that starts to look like things such as teams of 4 to 6 teachers who come together maybe once a half term, and they focus explicitly on some element of classroom practice that they want to think about that is an individual challenge or area of curiosity for them. And what they're finding is that the social element of that 4 to 6 group of teachers who are coming together to think constructively about solving the thing that one of them wants to really talk about is having real traction. So I think scaling up is difficult because of resource, but I think what we're seeing is some really fantastic alternatives to think about how we can do that given those constraints. The other thing I'd say in that is that one of the things that I learned when I was training as a coach is that you can have what they called a coaching way of being. So rather than think of me having a coaching conversation where Dave and Michelle meet at 3:30 and we're there for maybe 30 minutes or 45 minutes where there's nothing else happening, that's a high resource. But what we could do is we could have the agreement that if Michelle comes into the curriculum office with Dave, and Dave is that leader in that office, and Michelle says something like, gosh, I really don't know how I'm going to do this differently with my year 9. Dave might say, do you want to take a minute and we'll have a coaching chat? And in a 2-minute conversation, you might help me to think about that differently. So do we need to think about this as big chunks of time, or do we need to think about reframing some of the conversations that we have?
So correct me if I'm wrong, but what I'm getting from this is it's about having more productive conversations. Like, the training itself is about how we can have better conversations as teachers in terms of directing each other through questioning and through sort of understanding and listening and then asking the right questions, as opposed to saying, you know, oh, what should I do with my year nine class? You should do X. So it's about training in the sense of, like, instead of saying you should do X, how do we ask the right questions to get where we want to be?
Yeah, for sure. And listen, you know what? If you had an ECT in the office and they say, right, I'm out of options here. I don't know how to assess the learning that's going on in the whole class. Give me some ideas. Now you've got to step right back into that mentoring role, right? And you've got to give solutions. But if the time is right and the coachee is ready for a conversation that says, okay, how could you do that differently? Let's think together about that. It doesn't have to be all of the resource-heavy way of working that we've talked about. In an ideal world, wouldn't that be lovely that every teacher had, you know, some time set aside reasonably frequently to really reflect and think hard about stuff? But I think the reality of the world of education right now would make that quite challenging. It does happen in some places, but not without the resourcing and the time that we've talked about. So there are just, it's worth looking at other ways of doing that.
Fantastic. So we're going to go to the news now, everybody, in the next ad break. So stay tuned and keep listening. And then when we come back, we're actually going to do some coaching and, you know, Michelle's going to show us how it all works. So stay tuned.
Podbean, your message amplified.
Ready to share your message with the world? Start your podcast journey with Podbean.
Podbean, the AI-powered all-in-one podcast platform.
Thousands of businesses and enterprises trust Podbean to launch their podcasts.
Use Podbean to record your podcast.
Use Podbean AI to optimize your podcast.
Use Podbean AI to turn your blog into a podcast.
Use Podbean to distribute your podcast everywhere.
Launch your podcast on Podbean today.
This is Teachers Talk Radio. And this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC focuses on unpaid and low-paid internships, which a new study says are unfair to working-class graduates and increasingly favour those from a middle-class background. Research from the Sutton Trust is featured in the report, and it says the gap between the two demographics is growing, driven by employers continuing to underpay interns and giving opportunities to family and friends rather than advertising them. A poll of 1,200 recent graduates shows half have undertaken an internship, a 12% increase since 2018. But the gap between working and middle-class graduates has widened from 12% to 20%. The proportion of working-class graduates completing an internship is now only 36% compared to 55% for their middle-class peers. There is also a north-south divide, with graduates in London more likely to have undertaken an internship than those in the West Midlands, Yorkshire and Scotland. The report also says that in many cases, those undertaking unpaid internships were able to do so only because they received money from parents, lived at home or with family or friends, or used savings to support themselves. The Sutton Trust also found that internships were almost twice as likely to have been found through family and friends in an organisation compared to an advertisement, further contributing to the widening access gap. As part of its Make Work Pay plan issued before the election, Labour said it wanted to ban unpaid internships, aside from those that form part of an education or training course, although details haven't been confirmed. According to ITV News, Brighton University Academies Trust is to stop running several schools after an alleged budget scandal. The Trust has reportedly told government it plans to hand its portfolio of academies over to other providers. The Trust currently runs 11 primary schools and 3 secondary schools in Sussex, and is believed to have kept around 20% from individual school funding. Staff at five of the schools in the trust went on strike earlier this year. In a letter to parents, the trust says it is facing times of challenge and times of change. And a spokesperson for them said the trustees have informed the Department of Education of their desire to seek to transfer the academies in the trust to other academy trusts. A DfE spokesperson said they would work to select the strongest alternative providers for each of the schools to ensure a smooth transition. Further details can be found on the ITVX website. In a government website press release, the Education Secretary Bridget Phillipson announces what is described as a digital revolution. As part of her keynote address at the BET Show, she set out plans to harness technology to transform teaching. By using tech at every stage, she stated this would break down barriers to opportunity by ensuring every student and teacher can access the tools and support they need to succeed. She also spoke about artificial intelligence as a radical modernising force for change, whilst acknowledging safety concerns and a plan to work with tech companies to make AI safe for classroom use. Phillipson also spoke about plans to use tech to transform outcomes for vulnerable pupils, including those with SEND, by improving accessibility for all. Full details can be found on the gov.uk website. Finally, the Glasgow Herald features advice to students planning to start university this autumn. The article serves as a reminder of the approaching UCAS deadline on the 29th of January at 6 p.m, including the online form, personal statements and letter of recommendations from schools, which all must be uploaded. Late applications are possible, but only those received by the deadline are guaranteed to be given equal consideration by universities. The article also refers to the Sunday Times Good University Guide 2025 to help students make their choices, with the London School of Economics taking top spot. Scotland's oldest university, St Andrews, is in second place. Top 10 places are also awarded to the likes of the Universities of Oxford and Cambridge, University College London and Loughborough University. This has been Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishers of professional development books and resources that support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Don't miss out. Level up your professional development today and visit johncattbookshop.com to explore the full range of titles. Use the code JCTTR2425 for 20% off your order. Happy reading.
Meet USA Study, your one-stop platform for guiding students through their college application journey. Access up-to-date resources on universities, programs, scholarships, and application requirements, all in one place. Get easy-to-access tools, personalized timelines, expert tips, application templates, and exclusive webinars with admissions officers to help your students stand out. Visit usastudy.co.uk or call Phil at 0800 612 8271, because every student deserves the opportunity to shine with USA Study.
This show is...
And we're back. So just before I bring Michelle back and we keep talking about coaching, I just want to say a big shout out to everybody I met at the BET exhibition last week. It was an incredible experience. I met lots of teachers from around the world. So if you're listening today and I met you from... at BET and you're listening from somewhere in the world and you're tuning in, welcome. It was fantastic to meet you. So back to the show. And as Michelle and I sort of previewed before we got into this, we thought the best way to demonstrate how coaching works and really sort of give you a basis for it is to do a coaching session so teachers can sort of see the conversations, see how it might help them. We didn't think there was any better way than actually putting it to the practice. So I'm a little bit nervous because the topic I've chosen, but let's go, Michelle.
So should I take it away, Dave?
Yes.
Okay. So if we were having a real coaching conversation that wasn't being listened to by lots of other people, we would have a contracting discussion. And in that, we would agree how much time we would have for this conversation. We would clarify our roles. So I would work along a continuum of instructional coaching where, as I said, at one end, it's a little bit more, I'm going to give you ideas if you're stuck. In the middle, we're going to do dialogical work where we both bring ideas to the table. And then at the other end of the continuum, I am literally there just to facilitate your thinking. So I'm not going to be giving you my ideas. We're going to be really just working on yours, okay, and expanding those. And we're not going to stay in one place on that continuum, Dave. But if you were, you know, a less experienced teacher, I'd just check out that you were okay to receive ideas if that was what you wanted or that you could ask for them. So we would contract how we were going to do this. We would talk about confidentiality. So again, in schools, that can be a real issue. You know, to, you know, is the teacher able to talk to the coach in the knowledge that no information is shared beyond that? And are there times when it would be really helpful to share some of that information? So we would talk that through, and I would share whatever the decision would have been. We talk about who was going to note take. Because sometimes the coachee just loves to think and they say, could you just jot some ideas down so that I can just think and not worry about it, and then you share your notes later, or vice versa. And so we would just do a contracting conversation to get going. So we'll assume we've done all of that, Dave, and that you're going to manage what you say and don't say in front of all these lovely people that are listening to us. So what we'll do is I'll agree with you first up. How long would you like to give this, Dave?
Oh, about 20 to 25 minutes.
Okay, right. So the first thing then that I'm going to get you to do is just, well, number one, I just want to put you at your ease, okay? All we're going to do is we're going to have a conversation, and I want you to feel really comfortable that you're in charge of this conversation. I'm here to serve you and to support you and to help you. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to do is think about something that's really important to you. But I want you to know that you get to choose what you share. You get to choose what you don't. And you can have some thinking time and it be silent between us, and that you're not to worry about that in any way, because sometimes just some thinking time is what's needed. And I'm going to summarize back to you some of your thoughts to help you clarify whether they are indeed what you feel and think, so that you can really get inside some of those thoughts that sometimes just going really fast around your head. We're just going to slow them down and expand them. And what you're going to see me doing is using what I'm going to call the growth coaching structure. So this is a really well-established structure for our conversation. It was started by Jim Knight back in the 70s as the GROW model. So what you're going to find out we're going to do is we're going to explore the goal that you're interested in talking about. We're going to think about the current reality and what the reality might look like if you improved it. We're going to look at the options, that's the O. We're going to think about what you will do. And then the GROW model was expanded to the GROWTH model with TH at the end, with T being, do you want to explore some tactics about how you're going to do this activity or action as a result of the conversation? And how do we make those into habits so that you can sustain your new way of being or thinking? So you'll see us working through that model. And it isn't linear, so we might go forward and step back now and again. So just be at your ease. Don't worry. It's all good. Okay?
Okay, sounds great.
So if we were to give some time to something that really matters to you, Dave, what would that be?
So I've been thinking about this a lot, and it's, you know, there's so many things. But I came up with the idea, and I'm, again, you know, even now I'm thinking through it myself. The idea that I had was to be less stressed about students' results. Okay. But even saying that out loud makes me wonder, like, is that even something I want to change? But I would say, just in sort of a background to people listening, I get very stressed about my students' results every year. It's something I take very personally. I get very focused. So I only teach A-level. So I think the results day is around the 17th and 16th of August every year. And it's a day that I really, really hone in on, like, how good my leadership of my department has been and how good my own personal teaching has been really comes down to me on that day. And so I have been thinking a lot about whether that's a good or a bad thing. Is that what makes me a good teacher because I'm so focused on that? And what would it look like to be less stressed about that day?
Okay. So it's number one, it sounds like you're super invested in those young people. So, you know, that's just that just hats off to you to start off with. But it also sounds like that gets a bit uncomfortable at times.
Yeah, well, 100%. Like I said, the exam results day in August is, you know, obviously it's at the end of the summer. It's always looming there in the background, you know, and I always, you know, it's the first thing like on that day. I'm usually overseas, so I can be in Australia. I've been in all sorts of countries. But let's say because I am Australian, like I will be this year, I'll be in Australia. You know, I don't sort of, what would you say, naturally go on the time zone, like in the sense that I will get up at whatever time that would be. I'm trying to think what would be in Australia, maybe late at night because I'm going back or whatever it would be. But yeah, I make sure that when those results come out and then I'm like focusing, I'm doing calculations, I'm working out how it compares to last year. So it's all those, yeah, sort of aspects in the sense like that. Yeah, even thinking about it now, it's a lot.
Yeah, it sounds it. And because you had done some thinking about what you wanted us to talk about, we can zone in straight away on that goal. Sometimes it might take a bit of conversation to kind of work out what the goal is for the person that they want to talk about. But we're going to zone in straight away because you've done some thinking, you've identified that. So what I'd like you to do, Dave, is just tell me a little bit about what it feels like to be in your head, either on results day or at different points in the period leading up to that.
It's, yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that it's stressful. There's no doubt that it is something that I think about, you know, when I'm looking at figures and after mock exams and those sort of things. It's, yeah, it takes up a lot of my thought in terms of like working it out, going back, looking at how my institution judges results, thinking about where we're going with those results, how it will compare, what it will look like. And then there's, you know, I mean, what I would say is the results have been quite good over the last few years. So it is that elation, like when you actually, I guess it's like anything, you build up a lot of stress and you're really concerned. And then when you actually work out that like, oh, it is good, then there's this sort of almost release of like, oh, amazing, we did it. And then, but what happens is, of course, and I'm sure every teacher can relate to this in my position, you're like, okay, did it. That was amazing. I feel great. Super successful. Right, let's start again. Yeah. And so it's like, right, okay. And then it's just, you know, so I guess what I'm looking at is to break the cycle. Having said that, one of my great fears is that, I guess this is why I was interested in this as a topic, is I've sort of convinced myself that the reason the results are good and the reason we do well is because of that stress. Like, because I'm so razor focused, and if I was to let go, then the great fear is, well, they wouldn't be as good.
Okay. So it sounds like you've almost created a relationship in your mind with, if I don't feel like this, the results won't be as good. You've built an association between those two things.
Yeah, 100%.
That's
yes.
Really interesting. Okay. So if I get you to think about what would you like to feel? Can you tell me what you would be feeling if this was better for you?
That's a really hard one, because then I get sort of worried about, you know, am I like then becoming less focused on my students? But I guess it would be a feeling of, I know what works. I've done it long enough to know that it works. I don't need to be so fixated on it. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, in a sense, I've done my best, and that's all you could do. And so less, you know, it is what it is in a sense. But then I get scared of that, if that makes sense. Like,
okay. So that's really interesting to me, because it sounds like that you acknowledge that some level of stress or worry or level of concern is healthy, because it demonstrates to you that it matters, but that when that turns into what sounds like uncomfortable stress, then it feels a little less controlled, and that it sounds like you would like to reduce the intensity of that stress so that it feels like it matters, but it doesn't feel like it grabs you in the way that you're describing.
Yeah. I mean, a perfect example, it just came to me when you're saying that, is that, like I said, I'm usually away for the summer and I've been in different countries, and I'm like, you know what I'm going to do this year? I think this year I was in Italy. The previous years I've been in France. Like I said, I've been in Australia. Like, you name it, I've probably been there. Well, the results come in. Hmm. And every time I've told myself, like, I won't check it. You know, I'm on holidays. Yeah. What does it matter? I'll get to it when I get back. It's absolutely fine. Like, it doesn't make that much of a difference now. And of course, what happens is that isn't what I do. I'm like, I'm ringing people. I'm on my computer. I've been on a beach in Sardinia. I can actually remember it came to me. A beach in Sardinia discussing what the results look like when I couldn't access them. Yeah. You know, it's almost like, what would be the best description? You know, like something where you're like, I want to put it off. I can do it. And then you're just like, maybe some people who are trying to do dry January can relate to it. That sort of feeling of like, I know I can stop. And then you're like, oh, it wouldn't hurt just to have a peek. Oh, I'll just look for 10 minutes, you know, I'll just have half a glass of wine, like that sort of feeling. And then it just, So there hasn't been a results day, in a long time where I've been able to resist that urge to just have, and then I don't just have a peek. That's the truth. I'd like start crunching numbers. I'm bringing up stuff from last year, you know, like, so yeah, it'd be nice to be able to like take it. It's important, but maybe I don't have to necessarily give up a whole day of my holidays to start crunching numbers right there and then.
Okay. So what you're saying to me, I think, Dave, it sounds like that it matters, and you want to create a place where you acknowledge that it matters and that you get the information that you're really looking forward to and dreading a bit, but you want the information, but you don't want it to be all consuming.
Yes, 100%.
Okay, so that's really helpful. So what we're actually doing here is we're refining our goal. So this is, how do I get the bits that I want on results day, and that bring me the sense of accomplishment and, you know, information, good or bad, but that what I find out, then I am able to perhaps put in a box until I can actually then unpack that box and then do something with that information, analyze that data, make some plans.
Yeah, because, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, the plans don't need to be made on a beach in Sardinia on August the 17th, you know, like the things that went at that stage, yeah, you know, could be looked at a later time with my team or whatever, you know, like in that sense, they don't need to be stressed and pulled over at that moment.
Sure.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a big lead up to that as well in terms of like, you know, I guess there's a lot of, there's an idea I think I've built myself that like I sort of said before, that the reason why, you know, our department's results are good, you know, there's no doubt about it. The reason why the department's results are good is because of this incredible intensity and sort of focus that I and maybe I put on my team on results. And if we sort of let go of that, there's a fear that like, oh, well, then we won't get the same results. We won't have that drive.
So what if we reframed what you're calling fear and intensity into interest and passion?
What difference would that, I guess my question back would be, what difference would that make, you know, in a way to my stress levels?
So rather than seeing this, the results as something that, actually, I won't know until that date in August. So the results, in a way, are the outcome of all the work that led up to that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if we see that the team and you are worried about it, if we reframe that to say, I'm really invested in this, it matters to me. And because I'm invested in this, these are the things that I could do that will really help that investment. So tell me a couple of the things that you do to make sure that you have, that there are going to be no surprises in August. What do you do as a teacher to make as known as possible what those results are going to be?
I mean, obviously you could look at and monitor mock exams,
right,
and those sort of aspects, but there's also a sense of trying to make sure that I have an understanding of basically nearly all the students that are part of the department. Now, I'm in a big department. I think this is where a lot of it comes from. We've got 170 odd students doing second year history. But in a way, almost trying to make sure that there's no student who goes missing out of that 170. Like, do we have a sense, and do my teachers have a sense of all their students who might be going sort of, I don't know what the West word is, but sort of undercover, like not exhibiting behavior that you'd be immediately worried about. So covering all your bases, trying to get on top of every single student, where they're going, the conversations we're having, trying to notice them, trying to keep everything on track. And like, I guess in a sense, trying to minimize surprises. But with that, just to add a second thing to it, that's one of the problems, is that every year there are surprises. And every year when I look at the results as well, like, even though they're good, I do fall into that trap of being like, oh, they're good, but oh, if I'd just done that bit more with this student, or I can't believe I didn't, and shouldn't I have seen that coming, and what happened with that student? I thought, like, I do tend to fall into the individual. I'm like, oh, we got good results, but I can't believe I let that student slip, or I should have noticed, or when I think back, maybe I didn't track that enough. So those are the things that I fall into.
Okay. So there's two things here for me. The first one is some thinking about what are the things that we do to really make sure that no one falls through any crack? And have we exhausted all of those things? And obviously, as a leader, Dave, you can't do it all. So what are the processes that you've set up in your team for all the people to make sure that they're catching all of the students? So is it worth, maybe, and we won't have time to do this now, but going back to the team and think, okay, how do we catch? How do we know? How reliable is what we do? Are we missing anything? So some thinking around that, so that you as the leader have a greater sense that you've done everything possible within your control that could catch those otherwise surprises. The second thing here is the idea that you are actually thinking about some of the things that are beyond your control. So you and I both know that sometimes, despite your very best intentions, a student does something that means that their results are either surprisingly great or surprisingly disappointing. Now, we're not saying, okay, we'll just accept that. But we are saying that if I've done everything that I can possibly do, that I've tracked my data, that I've got all these great mechanisms in place to make sure that the team are catching every young person through all of the great things that you do, and you're restless in making sure that you've got everything and you keep going back and reviewing it. And what did we learn last time? And how did we take that learning and apply it to now? So there's two places we could go here. I think the first one is just to take you back to the idea that what we want to do is make sure that we minimize those surprises. So what do you want to do next, Dave? Do you want to do some thinking about how you deal with what's beyond your control? Or do you want to go to thinking about how you can make sure that there are no surprises?
Definitely dealing with things that are beyond my control. That is, yeah, 100%. Like, I think my, you know, one of my biggest problems.
Okay. So the way that you laugh there tells me that you kind of know a little bit about yourself, that you are a bit like that. Is that fair?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, okay. Definitely.
So, you know, what ideas do you have for being a little bit kinder to yourself around how you could just accept that there are things that are beyond your control?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really hard question. I'm actually, like, I usually have an answer for everything, but I'm a bit out of answers there. I mean, that is, you know, the crux of the sort of the issues I have. I think, you know, one of the things I stress so much about is, you know, the results, and sort of getting into it is like part of like my department's results are very good, and we have a reputation for having good results, and I'm very proud of that, as any teacher would be. And it's almost become too much, though, in the sense that that's almost become sort of, you know, in a good way, but also in a negative way, like that's my identity. Like, what I stress about is, oh, if the results weren't so good this year, what would that mean for the reputation of the department? What would that mean for my reputation within my institution? Because every year it's amazing and every year we get kudos for it. But what would it look like? Would I get the same kudos, or would suddenly it sort of not look as good? You know, so there's that, you know, it's almost like I've put my institutional reputation on every year. The Department of History at my institution absolutely knocks it out of the park. That's great. I mean, it's fantastic, but it also has built up, I think, over the years too much of a like, oh, what if this one year? And then with that, yeah, the things out of my control. Actually, the truth is I don't really have an answer, Michelle. I mean, that's the crux of it. Like, I don't, yeah, I'm not really sure about that.
So if we had more time, what I'd be getting you to do now is I'd get you to draw three concentric circles inside each other. Mm-hmm. And in that middle zone, those are the things that you can control, okay? Mm-hmm. The second layer out are the things that you can influence. And then the third layer out is the things that you can't control. And I get you to do some work really identifying, you know, I can analyze our mock data. I can make sure that every teacher is having regular touch bases conversations with their students, and all of the other things, all the other activities that you can do that you can control. Then I get you thinking about the things that you can influence. You can influence students, but you can't control what they're going to write in the exam. You can influence their time management, but you can't actually control how they use their time in the exam. So I'd actually get you to sketch out, what are the things that you can control? What are the things that you can influence? And what are the things that you cannot control? And then what I'd get you to do is to start thinking about, okay, on results day, when you, because you're passionate and interested, you look at that data as it comes in, then you say to yourself, okay, there's some information in this data. That's all the data is. So on results day, I hope that because of my proven track record, that I'm in the ballpark of what looks great, recognizing that progress isn't always just a nice linear line upwards. It gets messy sometimes. So I get you to think about your expectations and recognize that they're within a range of what looks great. And that as long as your performance is within a range, actually, it was great performance. Because what it sounds like is people like you, if it's less than last year, it's not great. But actually, less than last year could be absolutely brilliant for the cohort. So I'd get you to do some thinking about, you know, where your expectations are every year, and are they within a range rather than at a point? I'd get you to think about what you can control and therefore should and take responsibility for, but also what sometimes you have to accept that, yes, it's disappointing, but if you couldn't control it, but you did try to influence it, then, you know, those are one of those things that sometimes you've got to chalk up and just be a bit kinder to yourself.
Hmm.
And if on the results day you get information, because that's all results are, and you know that at a time of your choosing, which could be on the same day, but could be 2 weeks after, you and your guys are going to really unpack that data and you're going to do some analysis and you're going to take some actions forward. And then the really important thing about data is that you can't change what has happened, but you can use it to influence what will happen next.
Hmm.
So I'd get you to do some thinking about how well you analyze that. Oh, I know you analyze it really well, but how you
right? Yeah, I just laugh because I like I sort of analyze it to death, yeah, and then go, you know, yeah, maybe. I mean, I do love stats, I'm a bit interested, but yeah, maybe. I mean, again, it's another question, isn't it? Like,
yeah,
how much is too much, and like really honing in. But then I do think sometimes you can think, oh, the results are good, but maybe we missed this part that can help you next year. Sure. But it is one of those aspects. But yes, analyzing data is definitely not one of my issues.
Yeah, for sure. So if we try and start to wrap this up, Dave, what are the things that you've thought about that you might commit to taking forward? What do you want to do with your thinking now?
Acceptance. Yeah, I think that was a big one.
Okay.
You know, like that's the big thing I think I need to work on, like accepting that in the end there are things out of my control,
mm-hmm.
and that accepting that is a big thing. So working on that is sort of the big aspect of it.
Okay.
You know, and then also just when you were talking, it's like, okay, thinking about that, what is the impact I'm having on my own team? Like, am I reflecting that stress too much on them? Are there aspects that, you know, maybe I've sort of, you know, like we've got a really good team, but is there something that I'm sort of putting on them? So I'm not totally sure about that, but something I can reflect on, like, what impact is my, you know, sort of focus, almost over focus having on my own team.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the big ones. And then, yeah, like the idea of sort of trying to move away that the results are my institutional reputation. I think those are the big ones. If I can decouple that, like we get good results, that's fine, but that's not just who I am as a teacher.
Yeah.
I think those are the three big things I'd like to take away from our conversation.
Great. You've been coached. Well done.
Fantastic. Let's go to our last ad break and we'll come back and reflect on what we just talked about.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishers of professional development books and resources that support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Don't miss out. Level up your professional development today and visit johncattbookshop.com to explore the full range of titles. Use the code JCTTR2425 for 20% off your order. Happy reading.
Meet USA Study, your one-stop platform for guiding students through their college application journey. Access up-to-date resources on universities, programs, scholarships, and application requirements, all in one place. Get easy-to-access tools, personalized timelines, expert tips, application templates, and exclusive webinars with admissions officers to help your students stand out. Visit usastudy.co.uk or call Phil at 0800 612 8271 because every student deserves the opportunity to shine with USA Study.
This show.
Cool, and we're back for the last part of our show. I guess my first question to you, Michelle, is, I mean, you've coached obviously with lots and lots of teachers. I guess what I was thinking of when I was doing that conversation is what I'm talking about unique, or is that something you see with a lot of teachers that, you know, stress about results, sort of almost overstressing, really sort of almost control like, in a sense? I mean, you can tell me if I'm sort of, no, I'm a bit of an outlier, or is what I was talking to you something you see a lot?
Well, I think there are two parts to that. I think the first one is, whether it's like other people or not, it mattered to you.
Mm.
Therefore, if it's in your head and it's taking up energy and brain space and thinking about it more deeply, it actually doesn't matter what it is or whether it's common or not.
Mm.
So that's the first thing I would say. The second thing I would say is, welcome to the world of loads of curriculum leaders.
There
is that sense. And I think we have come a long way in this world of, moving away from harsh judgment and evaluation, but teachers care. And so whether you are, like you, a leader of a big team, which delivers great results for a large number of students, or whether you are starting out early in your career, I think the weight of responsibility for a young person's qualifications, we bear that heavily. And what we forget is that they're not our qualifications. And teachers almost, if they could sit these exams for these young people, because they want it for them so much, they would. And, there's a really fine balance in making sure that our students take responsibility for their part in it, versus our passion, our care, our sense of, responsibility for those grades. So I think you're absolutely not on your own on that, Dave.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, just a reflection on that. I think it's, like, for me, it's one of the toughest things. Like, you want them so badly to do well, and then sometimes you, and even when you get back exam papers, you're like, oh, how could they have written that? I not explain it well? Did I not do this? Instead of the sense of, like, well, under pressure, something just went askew and there's not much more I could have done.
No, exactly that. And I think, that's the hard part, isn't it? That, we're not in their heads. We facilitate their thinking. We guide their heads, but we're not in there. It's not our stuff. And it's the really hard part of wanting it so badly for a young person, because we know the value of those qualifications, but equally then acknowledging and relinquishing ultimate responsibility for those grades, which we do play a part in, but we can't take full responsibility for.
I just had a thought. Like, I know, obviously, confidentiality with coaching, but what would you say are the most common aspects that teachers come to you with in terms of coaching and things they want to work on?
It's really varied, Dave. So for leaders, it's, how do I lead other people? How do I support and engage my team? In other work, I talk about the idea that as a leader, it's my responsibility to support every member of my team to be better in July than they were in September. And that's really what leadership is in education. It's growing the grown-ups. It's helping them to progress so that in their classrooms, they're doing an absolutely cracking job of making sure that those young people get a great experience. And that's what, for me, what leadership is all about. So if you're a leader, it's often about how do I help the grown-ups in my team to be absolutely brilliant at what they do? So it can be about, leading people. It can often be about leading change. So somebody might say, look, we've identified that, the levels of challenge in our school aren't appropriate. We're not really stretching our young people. How do we do that collectively? So they can be quite big kind of change management projects. How do I start that? And so, really thinking about something that feels a little bit overwhelming, and then using coaching as a way to really start to plan that thinking. And that process of moving from where we are now to where we want to be, which in education, to be fair, can be sort of a two to three year piece of work sometimes. We're very fond of quick fixes in education. And I actually don't believe that there are many things that we can fix quickly. They take time. And then it can be about, the idea that we're trying to, for example, at the moment, one of the key things that lots of people are talking about are their struggling to find really effective ways of meeting the needs of young people who have a learning need, because we've seen a increase in the range and frequency of young people who have specific learning needs in our classrooms. And many of our teachers have a less than sharp toolkit to support those young people. So in coaching at the moment, there's often, you know, questions and reflection around how we meet the need of different learners. So it's really broad, but there are themes for sure.
Yeah, and just on a practical level, in terms of teachers setting out, you know, coaching CPD, starting for the first time, how much would you say they need to script out their questions, sort of sit down and write out, like, okay, these are the questions, like if you're sort of got an idea beforehand of what the person you're going to be coaching with is focused on, how much would you say, like, someone who's beginning this for the first time to actually sit down and write questions out?
That is a really, really great point. I think when I was doing my coaching training, the thing that I found hardest was to not jump in and say, ah, you need to try this. Or, you know what, I've got an idea here. Or this is what I've seen work somewhere else. And what you realize when you're training is that actually it's not about what I think. I'm here because it's about what you think. So I am here not to tell you what's in my head, but to explore with you what's in yours. And so I think that scoping out some questions when you're a less experienced coach is a really great way of making sure that you stay focused on listening. That's the most important thing in coaching. And listening not to respond to what you're hearing, but listening to understand. And what happens is that if you scope out your questions before you start, then it helps you to stay focused on listening to what's being said. So, for example, when we were doing our work there, Dave, you know, we started off by, you know, you gave me a goal quite quickly. But if I had the question, you know, where have you seen this working somewhere else in a way that is attractive to you? Then that question would have gotten you to think about, well, what do I want this to look like? If I'd asked you, what ideas do you have that could be helpful here? Then I've given you a question that, again, taps into your thinking. It doesn't tell you what I'm thinking. Now, obviously, if you as the coachee said, Michelle, have you got any ideas about, then that's different. You've asked me to kind of come into partnership with you. But scoping out your questions is a really great idea. And you know what? Don't feel that you've got to start with a blank piece of paper. There are some fantastic, all you need to do is Google growth coaching questions, and you'll come up with lots and lots of ideas. And it's not about asking all of them. It's about maybe picking a question that just opens up that thinking. And then what I found is that as I became a little bit more experienced and was not so obsessed with, I want to fix this, I want to help you, I want to tell you what I know, then you start being far more intuitive with your questions, because you're so locked in to what the other person is saying and you're so locked into playing it back to them. It sounds like this matters to you. Tell me a little bit more about. One of the things you said was, so you're really using what the coach is giving you to frame your next question. So start off with some scripted questions is really helpful, because it will help you overcome that desire that we have to help, support, butt in, offer. And then as you get more in tune with just listening and engaging with what you're hearing, then you feel maybe the need to have those scripted questions a little bit less.
That's so interesting. Yeah, because I guess one of my quick questions I was going to ask you was, like, how much or how do you plan out your coaching now?
So I use that growth model. So I know that we've got to agree where we want the conversation, what we want it to achieve. We explore that reality. We look at some options. We get you to think about what you will do. And then if we've got time, we then might even go into the tactics and habits to get there. So I always use that structure. So I know exactly where structurally the conversation will go. What I don't know is how quickly we're going to get there. Because what can happen is that partway through a conversation, a little bit like we did, you know, in a small way, you started off with saying, I want to be less stressed about student results. But where we went to was actually, how do I manage that almost on results day, right? Mm. So we kind of refined as we went. And then that kind of redirected me. And, you know, then you know, a number of things started to open up for me about you, which was, you know, this idea that, you know, you reflected that I'm mindful that I put my intensity or could put my intensity and my passion onto the team. And that was a real thing that came out for you. It was one of your takeaways. And that idea about wanting to control sometimes the things that are beyond your control. So we play around with that a little bit and maybe get you to think about that a little bit more deeply and about where you wanted that to go, not where I wanted it to go, but where you wanted that to go.
And I guess in schools that are embracing coaching as a CPD model, what does progression look like? You know, in certain aspects, you could say, well, if we're doing this as our CPD, you could see progression, you could see teachers developing. I mean, what does progression look like in coaching?
So I guess that one of the fantastic things about education is we never get to a destination, right?
Mm.
So, you know, so for example, if a school is saying, right, we're going to adopt Rosenshine's principles as our way of making sure that every teacher is super effective in the classroom. So progression might look like a coachee saying, okay, I'm going to start with zoning in on Rosenshine's principle of introducing new material in small steps. So I might then spend some time coaching, really thinking and modelling how I'm going to do that better as a teacher. And then I might literally move on to, okay, another element of Rosenshine's principles. So it could be that you're just moving through the things in your classroom that you want to build a repertoire in. But it could also be the fact that, look, you know, I've become reasonably expert, but over the last 3 or 4 years, I'm starting to see that how students used to respond is changing. So I think we're all noticing in our classrooms a shift in, you know, student independence, for example, or student resilience. We're talking about their mental health a lot more. We're talking about their ability to stay focused and cope with pressure. So what happens is that as a teacher, I can be really skilled and experienced, but society shifts. So I now need to sharpen a different tool to cope with, I don't know, a cultural change or a societal change or a DfE-driven change, if that matters to you. You know, so progression can look like a number of different directions. I think the important thing is that you are responding to what you can see in your own practice that could do with being sharpened or improved or deepened, and coaching can be a great tool for that.
Mm. So my follow-up question would be, just to thinking about schools and institutions that are taking on this as a CPD model, does it work in the sense if you're like, this is what everybody's going to be coaching or being coached? Does that work, or does it only work when teachers are volunteers? Like, can it work where it's like, you are going to do this? Like, you don't really have a choice. You could do it well and you can develop it, but this is how we're going to do things. Or does it really only work if teachers are volunteers?
Great, great way of thinking about it. And I think what's at the heart of this is the difference between people being invested and people being compliant. And I think, you know, the reality is that it's going to be more effective if people lean into it. Mm-hmm. If I am a reluctant coachee, then I might go through the process of being coached, but to what extent am I going to embrace the learning as a result? So at its best, it happens in those organisations where if we're all going to do it, then we all see the benefits, we all understand the why, we all have, decided that there is worth in doing and engaging with coaching. So I think if everyone in an organization leans in, hopefully as a volunteer, I think that is where it happens at its best. I think if that's only for a few people, then you know what? I wonder whether it's a good use of resource to use it if somebody is really, you know, not engaged, because I don't know the extent to the impact of that would be.
Yeah, that's a really, really insightful thought to end our conversation on. So, I mean, I can't believe I've got so many more questions. I think we could talk for another half an hour. We are unfortunately out of time. Michelle, that was incredible. I'm really, really grateful for you coming on this Friday night and talking to myself and all the listeners and all the teachers who are interested in it, what coaching is and how it works. And thank you so much.
I'm super grateful to you as well, Dave, and to everybody that hopefully will just at least explore coaching a little more as a result. So thank you.
No problems. Thanks so much. Okay. So that was the show for tonight, everybody. I thought that was an incredibly interesting conversation. Like I said, I could have talked for a lot longer. I hope you got something out of it and have a bit more insight to coaching. See you all in February.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.